Good evening, listeners. It is the 30th of September, 2018, and you're tuned in to 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It is currently just after 7 p.m., and on a Sunday, that can only mean one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Lori Lutz.
And I'm Kristen Finch. At Oregon State University, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. If you're a graduate student at OSU and you're interested in coming on the show, or you just want to find out more about all the awesome things happening at Oregon State, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all about our up-and-coming guests and links to our Twitter and Facebook pages.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or the station. Tonight, we are joined by Atharta Tulader. We are so happy that you could join us, and do you just want to get us started by telling us a little bit about your lab and what you do?
Yeah, thank you very much. It's great to be in this show. I work in the lab of Dr. Khan Toomer, and the name of the lab is ADI, which is basically we work with autonomous agents and distributed intelligence. So the autonomous agents part is where we have, let's say, agents such as maybe robots that go out and learn how to do things, the tasks that they're assigned to do. And then the distributed intelligence is how do these robots that learn how to go and do things collaborate as a part of teams, either with other robots or maybe at some point with humans, and achieve a common goal.
All right, so just to sort of wrap our brain around this, maybe some of us are more familiar with one robot performing a task on its own. But what you're talking about is more robots working together to perform a task. So one, what is that? And why do we need to have multiple robots instead of just one?
Yeah, so definitely like having multiple robots is and will be necessarily for tasks that really need coordination. For example, let's say a practical example would be you send in a number of, let's say, five rovers to Mars, and they can't, like, if each one of them is going to go in their own direction and search for things, that is pretty much not going to be that efficient. And they're going to try to do things that maybe the other rovers have already learned to do. So making them work together as part of a team and maybe sharing information and learning from others' experiences kind of makes this whole learning experience more efficient. And also, if you look at maybe more task-oriented things, let's say if you need pictures of, let's say, a crater from three different angles to actually be able to observe it really well. Like, instead of one robot just going and like trying from different angles, if you have three robots, that makes the task much more easier.
All right. So this reminds me of, like, you know, my mom telling me growing up, like, learn from someone else's experience. But this is a little bit different than that, because the robots are learning from the other robots' experiences. But they're also more, I guess a better analogy for me is thinking like they're sharing a brain, really.
Yes. Yes. So like slightly more technical here, let's say if like I was a robot, then I would go out in the world and then try different things and then see like, oh, like I saw this, I saw this ball, I kicked it and then it just went flying forward, and then I maybe save that somewhere, and then another robot might, like, you know, look at that and say, like this robot did this thing, and then this is what happened of it. So, like, you know, I can learn something from that experience. So basically, they pool all of their experiences so that all of them can benefit from it.
So we're talking about the robots learning, and how is this learning achieved? How do the robots know, I guess, if you will, that they're learning something and that they're doing the right thing?
Yeah, so so that's when we kind of talk about the algorithms that we use. So one, let's say an umbrella of algorithms that, like, you know, we use is kind of called like reinforcement learning. And what that means is, in scenarios where you cannot write steps to demonstrate how to do a thing. For example, you are maybe juggling a ball, right? And then like these complex maneuvers that you do with your hands and fingers, there's no possible way to just write each step, like, you know, move your pinky this way or like things like that. So in those situations, all you can do is whether you did a good job or not at juggling. So reinforcement learning algorithms, as they suggest, reinforce your actions that were good. And like, you know, do the opposite for the actions that, like, you know, was bad. So basically, the only reward at the end you tell these robots or agents is whether you did good or bad, or like how good or how bad.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like training a dog.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so even with a team of robots, if you can, or if you have a team of robots and they do a task in a certain way, but then you take one out and replace it with a new robot, that robot still knows from the experience of all of the other robots situations that achieved a reward and situations that didn't achieve a reward.
Yeah, yeah, technically, yeah. You it's like our goal at the end would be to, like, not just, let's say if you had five robots, not just have that number as fixed, but then if robots come in and out but still be able to maintain, like, you know, be able to get to the task that you're assigned. Yeah.
So there's no like training day for a new trainee robot, right? It's like you can skip that step and maintain the efficiency of all the learning that the team of robots has already completed.
Ideally, that would be our goal.
Okay. Yeah. And so what are some of the other things that your lab is investigating about improving robot team situations?
Yeah. Before we touch on that, I was just going to say, like, what's the broader picture here, right?
Yeah,
Is it just, do we only care about robots going on to Mars, or is it something that, let's say, as anyone right now can, like, you know, see or know what, like, this technology is enabling? So multi-agent systems are like multi-robot systems. These can be applied to different things, such as even in like the Amazon warehouse, where that's like, you know, packaging and like bringing all the items that you order together to a human and then saying, like, you know, like basically doing a lot of the meat of the work that they have to do by intelligently coordinating among themselves, or even simple things that we take as granted, such as like air traffic management, right? If you think of all these individual towers, stations, or airplanes to be as agents, or like, you know, something like that, then you can say, like, how do they like collaborate? Or like, you know, in some cases, it could be how do they compete, right, to get to their task. So what our lab does is basically focus on these things. It doesn't have to specifically be robots in that sense. But then generally, if there are different things, different entities, or like, as we like to use the term, agents, how is the intelligence of having more than one agent in the environment kind of make the task more easier? Or like, you know, how do they actually, how will a group of agents achieve a task that is maybe in some ways could not or could never have been achieved by like a single agent?
Mm-hmm. So in order to do this, they have to have some way to communicate with each other. But that communication might not be something that we're familiar with. Can you tell us a little bit about how the robots or the agents communicate with one another?
Yeah, so that's an interesting field of study that's going on right now. There are definitely like agents that don't communicate. Let's say they just maybe observe what others are doing. That's definitely one paradigm. But then there's also another where like there's specific like communication channels, and that thought is interesting because even biologically, if we think about it, like communication emerged from the need to collaborate, right? Like it's not just like something we do because we like to talk all the time. It's because there's a specific need that we have that is only going to be accomplished if we can communicate. So with robots, let's say these rovers on Mars, and one robot sees something that might be important to other, and then like, you know, then that information transferring, communicating that is going to be really useful. So how they communicate that, or even not how they communicate, but how they learn to create their vocabulary is very interesting. And some of the research that I have seen in the past is like, robots don't necessarily need to use the same vocabulary as we do. Like they don't need to know what an apple is, like the same way we know an apple. Mm-hmm. It could be a number like 1.7 for what an apple means, or like, you know, just a arbitrary a series of letters of what an apple means. So one thing that's really interesting with this machine learning or reinforcement learning paradigm is that you don't even have to specify what the vocabulary means. So they would try to go back and forth with, like, you know, if you give them, you have to work with, let's say, A, B, C, D, E. You have these five letters, like you make out whatever meanings that you can. So they will like try to coordinate and also like, you know, talk or just like, you know, send out these signals, and they will make or just learn, or they will converge into their own meanings of what those symbols mean. And there's some promising research that, yeah, these can be actually efficient because the idea is that they will converge to the minimum number of like words that they need to use if they are penalized for talking a lot.
Okay, so you still try, so the programmer still tries to keep the language pretty pretty simple, like I guess the most parsimonious, you would say, or exactly. Something, instead of allowing the robots to kind of, I don't know, run with their language. But
exactly.
I think the really important thing here is that, or the thing that is really interesting to me is that they, just as they're learning the situation and they're being rewarded for the task that they accomplish, they're also from nothing except maybe the five letters that you're talking about,
right,
coming up with a whole language that is only the necessary language for their task.
Exactly. And also like the like they might learn to learn the most succinct language, because let's say even biologically, if you think like just talking requires energy, and same for robots, communication would require bandwidth. So just having a letter for everything that you can imagine is probably not a good idea, right? Mm-hmm. So if they can, so that's why we have language where like we only have 26 letters, but then how we arrange them adds meaning to like what we mean.
Yep.
So they would, like robots in that sense, like, you know, would converge to their own meanings with those letters.
Right. And we might not ever be able to decode their language.
Yes. And there's actually a lot of interesting research going on here at OSU where the project is called Explainable AI. And what they're trying to find out is, okay, we have these robots that, given a task, they go out and do these things. But then what are they really thinking? Like, you know, let's say, is it looking at, like, say, this giant hill beside me, or is it looking at something else like a puddle in front, or how and why are they making those decisions based on, like, you know, what they're doing? Yeah. So yeah, so I guess like there's some research direction there, and I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, it would be interesting, I guess, to know if there's a group of robots, for example, I guess maybe in the Amazon warehouse, like what is a big enough or a reason that they would need to communicate with each other, I guess. Like, what did they, you know, they're creating the language, they're creating the reasons for communication, mm-hmm, also. So it would be interesting to learn what reason they came up with a word for, like, over here or something.
Yeah, yeah. It could be exactly things like that. So example, let's say a contrived example, right? So I think that language is really necessarily when there's a physical implication of what's going to happen. Like the task has to have a physical embodiment. So example, let's say I was handicapped, right? And maybe someone glued me to this chair and I needed to get water. I was really thirsty. Only thing I can do is I can communicate to a person that's nearby me to get me a water because I physically myself can't do that. So like in a communication would emerge from the need to like have something done that you can't really do. So maybe in a warehouse situation or even in rovers in Mars, it could be like, you know, when a robot is trapped or like, you know, one robot needs some other robot to take an observation, right? Maybe this robot really found something that was interesting, but then its battery is dying out or something. And like, you know, it really needs the help from someone else or like, you know, just things like that, that would necessitate, that would require communication.
Very cool.
So before we move on to learning how you got into robotics, I want you to describe to us a little bit about like what in a day in the life of what you do in the lab, just for the people out there, because, you know, we've learned a lot about what you study, but like what does that look like for you on a day-to-day basis?
So since I'm just starting my second year, I do have to take some classes.
Yeah, of course.
So maybe 2 days in a week, I'm stuck at classes. But the rest of the time is basically, looking through, there's a website called Archive where you like look at what's the latest publications, things like that. And maybe like just every day, just go through that once and see if there's like anything new popping up. And then like there'll be one thing that I'm kind of working on in my head. And even if I'm just getting a coffee or something, I'm thinking, let's say, how would, let's say, a new type of algorithm fit or something. So that would be always in my head. And then like, you know, just doing other things in the day, let's say maybe doing homework. But then whenever I get some free time, just like working on that, that part, trying to advance that idea.
So you have a running algorithm or an algorithm that you're constantly kind of making improvements for that for these specific multi robot tasks?
Yeah, exactly. So like one of the, yeah, exactly. So so the thing is like it takes some amount of like time coding it.
Right.
So like it's not something I can just do over like a coffee talk or something. So I would have to really think hard and like look at how others did that thing. So like it just comes together piece by piece. So really like, you know, thinking not just writing, but then what would be like, what would that mean in a physical sense? Or like, you know, what's the greater idea that this like thing that I'm writing would actually mean. So things like that. So, yeah.
And then when you're testing your algorithm, what does that look like? So you have this algorithm, you've done a lot of writing for it, and now you want to give it a go with the machine learning. So how does that look?
So, we basically work a lot with simulators, and what that allows us to do is, as I said, like these reinforcement learning algorithms, they have to, try different things, right? They have to try different things and then see what was good and what was bad. So like basically if you were trying to learn how to lift up a coffee mug, you don't have like spare million coffee mugs that you can like, you know, let your robot destroy or something. So like we use simulators which like, you know, allow them to have the same feedback but then not really destroying anything, and also it makes the process really faster. So example, in let's say 24 hours they could have simulated like, you know, a million times how to like hold a coffee cup or something like that. Or yeah.
So for those listeners just tuning in, you are listening to Inspiration Dissemination, and we are here with Yatharta Tulader, and he is talking to us about his robotics research.
Yeah. And so, Yatharta, I wanted to kind of go back a little bit in time and find out a little bit how you got interested in robotics. But maybe you can tell us just how you, like, what is a, I guess, a moment where you kind of figured out your career path and kind of made the decision to, I don't know, abandon all the other kids' stuff that you were doing and focus on electrical engineering? Or
yeah, so so when I was back in Nepal, I'm originally from Nepal. So then the some of the few areas that were like popular was either working in hydropower or telecom or like construction, because like Nepal is not that developed, and then there's like even these really like, you know, these bare necessities like hydropower. Those are like people go into a lot of jobs like in that area. So I thought, you know, I will study hydropower or like telecom, something like that. So that's why, and like be able to come back to Nepal and like, you know, work in that. So that's why I choose electrical engineering, because like, you know, it's related to all these topics. So once after coming to US, I kind of realized that electrical engineering was like far more than just like how to make electricity or like, you know, how to make telephone to work. So, and after switching like two or three places, I tried to work in a photonics lab, for instance, or also work for like a student racing team. And then like just out of, I don't know, chance or luck, I fell into this robotics lab, because at that point I was like, you know, I've been trying these things and like, you know, I just need something to like really like build my talent and like, you know, have something on my resume, so I need to do something. So yeah, that's how I kind of ended up in a robotics lab, and like that's where like my interest kick off, and by maybe like 6 months in there or something, I was like, yeah, I'm not taking a job, I'm going to grad school.
Yeah. So were you working already, kind of starting to develop some algorithms in this robotics lab, or were you really just learning like conceptually what that was, or do you have any specific projects that you could tell us about?
Yeah. So I am working on like algorithms and trying to maybe in some cases develop new algorithms or like change algorithms that already exist. So one of the really interesting things is like also, as we talked about communication, right? So think about communication as maybe radios, maybe. And you have like, let's say five robots, and then there's like five radios turned on at the same time, right? Like how do you know what to listen to? Or even like, how do you even like pick out the necessary, like, you know, if there was a important message in one of those radios, like, you know, that we're talking. So it's all about like, what do you give attention to, right? So the same with if you're driving a car, you're not necessarily looking at the Bob Marley poster that's in on like, you know, a shop door or something. You're mostly looking at like, you know, the taillights, or like, you know, if there's pedestrians passing by or something like that. So you're visually, your attention is very local to like certain things. And so even in robots communicating, you don't want all of them talking at the same time. You want to be able to, like, if you were a robot, to look at your local scenery and say, is this something I need to communicate? Like, because it would be really annoying if you were just talking all the time.
Very cool. Yeah.
So you've had a lot of experience working in different robotics lab, and I know you're only in your second year here, but is there like, do you have some sort of like dream job or some robotics related challenge that you really want to work on when you're done with grad school?
Yeah, I really have a very nebulous idea of what that would be. I don't know what's the physical embodiment of that. Mm-hmm. So I would like to work in or like use robots to enable things such as like, you know, in remote areas. So how do we maybe send robots to help like, you know, people, let's say maybe even in search and rescue, or even places where access to medicine is like, you know, very hard. Mm-hmm. How do we maybe in some cases like use teams of robots to like, you know, go do surveys or search areas where maybe miners are trapped or something like that. We're working towards that. And really, like, this can be used in anything from maybe sending out robots to monitor wildlife or things like that. I would like to do some kind of humanitarian work.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah,
use your program or your robots and your algorithms for the greater good.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about your research is that you're working on this sort of general concept that can be applied in many, many different ways. So that's really cool.
On that topic of the huge application potential of robotics and like robots integrating into our daily lives even more than they are now, just for listeners who are maybe like, I don't know, mind blown by robots and how they can develop their own communication and could you tell us some of the ways that you really see like big advancements for different fields of study with the application of robots?
So applications of robots, is that what?
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering like what fields of study or what particular industries or areas do you think could really benefit or that we'll really start to see the benefits of having robots integrated or machine learning integrated into our those systems?
Yeah, definitely. So I would maybe tell you a small story about my internship this summer. So we're looking at, I've already heard of like Waymo and Tesla making these autonomous cars. So the company that I worked for this summer was interested in how do we do the same thing for off-road vehicles, for example, right? So it's going to be really hard to control this crane with like all these things going on, and like how do we use machine learning to kind of let the machine take over the hard part, and like, you know, the person just watch and say like, you know, whether that was a good thing to do or not. And also maybe this could be slightly contrived, but then think of all the autonomous cars that would be coming into like, you know, into the streets, right? And if you think of them as individual agents, right? Do you think they would be able to like communicate and kind of maybe negotiate like, you know, who's going to go first on the road, right? I think that is a possibility.
Yeah.
Because like, you know, that could actually help in eliminating traffic jams or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's like things like that. I think like, you know, are where like you can't really see some impact.
Yeah, so multi-robot systems like for the autonomous cars, for example, yeah, like could really help with merging.
Exactly.
Like, very like ways that you think autonomous cars could go wrong could be helped by these multi-robot systems.
Yeah.
Fewer traffic jams, fewer car crashes, because they're all running with the same brain, like you made the point earlier, Lori.
Yeah, which is really the cool thing, I think, with autonomous cars is, you know, if a car makes a mistake, only one has to make a mistake once, and then all of them can learn from that. So it's like the same accident happening in the same way, it would only happen once, because then they share that brain, they share that knowledge. And so really, I mean, I could see that being a huge, huge benefit.
Yep.
Right. Correct.
Yeah. So thinking about that in robots generally, the possibilities are endless.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, Yatharth, I know I've learned a lot just from talking to you for the last few days. But we are getting around to the end of our time for Inspiration Dissemination interview today. And we do have two traditions to get to.
So our first tradition is for you to share a bit of advice, whether that is for undergraduates or fellow graduate students or your younger self. So please share with us what advice you have and who it is for.
So maybe the first piece of advice would apply more to undergrads or like people who are maybe not even in school right now. So I think at this point, we really have a lot of good material, like lectures or like things like that in the internet that you really don't need to sit in a class and learn and like, you know, have a big student loan. So there's a lot of things that are out there that you can learn from free, and you can't can't make the excuse that, oh, I didn't go to school for this, or like, you know, there was no one to teach me, because the material is really rich. So another advice I think that would be to me, or I guess someone like me, who's trying to do research, what I've found quite, I guess, helpful is to also have one other thing that you care about rather than just your research. Because you could be like, oh, like, you know, for months you could be like, I want this algorithm to work, and like, you know, I'm not gonna eat, I'm not gonna, like, you know, sleep. But then I discovered like cycling and just like, you know, going outside, and that just helps me whenever I'm like, you know, stuck in something. I have something that I'm also interested in, I also want to pursue. So it's not just like, you know, stuck on this one line of code and I'm sad for the next week because of that.
Yes,
that's
definitely
good advice. Yep.
Self-care is so important. And I really like what you mentioned about all of these resources that we now have available to us, and to people who aren't even in school. And, you know, if you're interested in something, there are things available for you to learn more.
Yep. And then our second tradition is to ask you to provide a song for your outro. And so will you please tell us which song you have selected and a little bit about why?
Oh, yeah. So the song I selected was John Mayer's Waiting on the World to Change. I believe that's from the album Continuum. So this is one of the songs I listened to even when I was in like high school. The meaning, I really never thought about that. So I think the song, what it's trying to express is our current generation, let's say we want to make a change, and like we feel the need to make a change, but then we also feel that maybe we are encumbered by like so many things that we're not able to make a change. And then like, you know, we're kind of crying out, so like we want to see change, but then there's like we kind of feel kind of not powered enough. And then again, from the side of like, you know, people who are in a leadership position, or like, you know, who are maybe in politics, like, you know, maybe they are saying something like, you know, we want better for everyone, but then it's just that the like things are so unfair that, you know, even if we try to do good things, like they might not really end up in good things. So it's just this, like, you know, like how do we get across this barrier where, like, you know, even we want to like do good things, but we aren't able to. And even people in power who want to do good things, but then like there's some things that are just not right now. So we want the world to change.
Right. Yep. Well said. So Yatharta, thank you very much for coming on Inspiration Dissemination.
Thank you very much.
And this is Inspiration Dissemination. We're on every Sunday at 7 p.m. and we talk to graduate students each week. And thank you for listening. This is Waiting on the World to Change by John Mayer. And it's a request of our guest, Yatharta. You heard it on KBVR, Corvallis.